Actually, Mrs. Meyer, for inviting me here to speak today, I consider it a privilege to speak in front of a group of such professionals and experienced people such as yourselves. A lot of the things that I'm going to be telling you, perhaps you know already. Please make believe that you don't. A lot of the things that I'm telling you here today, you may be under just the opposite impression, or you may vehemently disagree with. It's very possible. My encounters with professional social workers and psychologists were not always peaceful. Our methodologies clash very often, as do our activities. I'm going to share with you my experiences and whatever my limited knowledge has and is, and I'm looking forward one day to the opportunity to have just the opposite, to understand from your experiences. Okay, we're here to deal with the topic of how to deal with acting out teenagers. Acting out teenagers are, of course, a very difficult thing to deal with, and I even received recently a letter from a psychologist, a doctor of psychology actually, who writes to me how impossible it is for him to deal with certain acting out teenagers from families. These kids are unreceptive to his therapy, they're not interested in talking to him, they're there only under duress, even under force by their parents, and he's somewhat at a loss as to how to work with them. You can bring the teenager to the horse, you can bring the teenager to the psychologist, but you can't make him think. That's the basic idea. Teenagers are, according to our Torah, very similar, let's say, to the hail of Mitzrayim, the Borod. The hail of Mitzrayim had a very interesting characteristic. It was ice on the outside, water on the outside, and had fire inside. There were two opposing forces of nature working in conjunction. They were two opposites in the same entity. That's a teenager. When a baby is a little baby, and when a kid is a little kid, he's totally and completely dependent upon the parents for emotional support, for physical support, and for just about everything. Later on, when he becomes an adult, he's totally emancipated from the parents, totally independent. Somewhere in between are the teenage years, between 13 and 19, where a child is somewhat still dependent on their parents, but in very many ways, an independent entity by himself. In fact, in halacha, a teenager is treated half like an adult and half like a child. A child under 13 is not responsible for any aveiros, for any sins at all. They're not punished at all. Somebody over 20 is punished across the board. During the teenage years, from the age 13 to 19, the person is punishable by bidei shemayim, but not bidei adam. Excuse me, it's just the opposite. A person is punishable bidei adam, but not bidei shemayim. The child gets punished by Bezdin, but the child does not get punished by Hashem. He's halfway between adulthood and childhood. And that halacha says exactly between the years of 13 and 19. Before 13 he's a katan, and after 19 he's totally responsible. The problem is that teenagers don't look at themselves like this. Teenagers, I find, don't understand, they don't realize that they are still partially dependent on their parents, they don't realize that they're going through an in-between phase and that they're nishtahin nishtaher, that they're in limbo. On the contrary, because of our society and because of the messages that we've been given them, because we have empowered them in very many ways, the teenagers believe that they are the epitome of our society, the zenith of humanity, and they are the they're the highest level that they're ever going to be at. We older people, anybody over 20, anybody over 30 or 40, deep down inside, because of the rules of our society, sort of jealous of those teenagers, and we all try to look and act younger than we are. Women who get older try to dress such that they're going to be perceived as younger than they really are. And a man, as soon as he sees his first white hair in the mirror, he screams. If a guy, if somebody's wife is sitting there in the living room and all of a sudden she hears her husband, let's say he's in low mid-30s, all of a sudden screaming, nothing dangerous happens. Baruch Hashem, what happened was he looked in the mirror and he found his first white hair. We are living in a youth-oriented society. And if we're living in a youth-oriented society, that tells us that youthfulness is really the epitome of humanity, and that's the best place to be, it's the best type of person to be. So then you have a teenager who's the epitome of youth, the epitome of physical prowess. They, according to society, are really on a much higher level than all of us. We are trying to look and be like them. They are not trying to look and be like us. In a real good society, and it's a halacha like this, the Bach says, at least regarding men, the reason why a man is not allowed to dye his hair is because regarding a man, it is a privilege to be older. And those white hairs indicate experience and knowledge. That's the way society should be. By us, it's just the opposite. I don't know any teenagers that wish they were older, wish they were 30 or 40 or 50. But I know many, many 30, 40, 50-year-olds that wish they were teenagers. And the teenagers know that we wish this. The teenagers know that they comprise a tremendous financial market for the Madison Avenue magicians that are selling us whatever they're selling us. Teenagers are targeted by the television, they're targeted by the advertising agencies, they're targeted in the magazines as people who have money. Teenagers have power in this society. They certainly do. And not only is it Madison Avenue that's empowering teenagers, it's us too. Because we live in a society that, a society of finger pointers, a society of victims. Like the woman who contracted cancer, and instead of clapping al chet for ignoring the warnings of the Surgeon General and of her mother and of her parents and of her teachers and of everything she read, she sued the tobacco company because it's their fault that she contracted cancer. If a child goes off the derech, it's automatically considered the parents' fault. And if a child's not doing bad in school, they call in the teacher to find out what they're doing wrong. If a child gets hit by the parents, and I'm sure you all know this, they are so quick to go to school and to tell all their friends how much they're abused at home. We want to protect our children and we want to shelter them and make sure that they're not harmed because they need us to protect them. But what's come out is that we've put ourselves on strings and made them like marionettes, and we've given them the control to a very large extent. If a teenager threatens the parents, and it happens all the time, I want this, otherwise I'm going to go off the derech, parents will very often give in. And the children know that. And even in schools, I was a teacher, I still am a teacher, I know how it works. If parents are going to tell the school, we are going to send our children to a different school, unless you teach this way or this topic or this type of things, the school is going to give in. And if the students tell the school, look, I want this and this, otherwise I'm going to go to a different school, unless the school could really sustain that damage, the school is going to be under pressure. And so what happens is that our youth, our teenagers, don't perceive themselves as people that are nishtahin, nishtaher, like the Bard of Mitzrayim. They don't perceive themselves as half adults. They perceive themselves as at the epitome, at the pinnacle, at the high point of their lives. Everybody else is over the hill. And we are giving them that message. They don't look at themselves as people that need help. Yeah, they may need help getting a job, they may need help getting into a school, they may need help with their schoolwork. But as people who need the skills to grow up, as people who need social skills, and as people who need maturity, they do not perceive themselves as that at all. And that's because of the society we live in. Truth of the matter is that the teenagers are exactly like us. There's a vote from the Rebbe Rabbeinu of Pshischa who said like this. He said, when somebody's a little kid, all he's interested in is candy. And somebody's a little bigger, they're interested in a little more sophisticated type of candy. Maybe they're interested in money. Kid gets a little older, he gets a license, now he's interested in driving fast cars. Gets a little older, he gets his yuppie's license, and now he's interested in making money. Then he gets older than that, and then he's interested in COVID. He's interested in being in honor and respect and power sometimes. If he gets older than that, if he's zoicha, if he's worthy of it, he understands that all he's interested in is Torah and mitzvahs. In other words, pursuit of happiness, anything other than Torah and mitzvahs, is just a level of immaturity. And yes, the teenagers are interested in their pursuit of happiness just like we are. Now, they pursue it in more self-destructive ways. But the first thing we have to understand is that their desires and their wants are no different than ours. we pursue happiness in perhaps less self-destructive ways, sometimes just as useless and just as worthless. I think that besides making an organization for the teenagers that are delinquent, I think we should make an organization for adults that spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on fancy houses. And we should make an organization on people that spend elaborate amounts of money on weddings and people who plaster the front of their houses with marble. Now, we laugh at this because we are those people. But the truth of the matter is we need an organization like that. We should have social workers and psychologists to explain to the people what a waste of money it is, and we should have rabbis explaining to them from a religious point of view how silly it is. Because we are running around like chickens without heads in the pursuit of happiness, and we're not really getting anywhere. A teenager that puts that buys a nickel bag of pot wants the exact same thing. Except he looks down on you because he knows that you're spending $100,000 on nothingness, and for those $5, at least he feels good for a few minutes. He looks at his adult counterparts as people that are running after money, as people that are over the hill, immoral, have no ideals whatsoever. He looks at himself as superior. And you tell him not to take pot, he'll laugh at you. Teenagers are the exact same things as us. They have the exact same desires. Just, they're a different culture. We tend to look at them as the opposite. We tend to look at teenagers as people from our American society. Just, they're growing up, so they have different drives and different motives. It's the opposite. The motives are the same. They want to be happy. They want to feel good. They want to be chashuv. So instead of getting a front seat in shul, he'll put on a leather jacket. Instead of a kapota, he'll put on a leather jacket. Instead of a Lincoln, he'll drive a motorcycle. It's more self-destructive, but the same idea. The thing with them is that they're a different culture. Teenagers think a little different. They have their own little society. They have their own language. They have their own rules of honor. And it's totally and completely a different culture than from which we come from. As social workers and professionals, you know that when dealing with somebody from a different culture, it involves totally different type of skills. And that's what teenagers are. I know that when the Russians came here from Russia into America, and we were ready with millions of dollars of tzedakah money to try to help them and make them from, and we sent them to Eretz Yisrael, and in Eretz Yisrael, and I'm not talking about the children, the kids now, I'm talking about the adult Russians that came here. Tens of thousands here in New York City, our efforts were an abysmal failure. I was the dean of an adult Russian school that was run by Bubba. There are many such schools. There still are. It's an abysmal failure because the Kirov methodology that we normally use for non-religious Jews don't work on Russians. Russians are a different culture and they have a different attitude. They're living all their lives under the communists where everything came to them, and if they didn't get what they wanted, the only way they can get it was through either trickery or underhanded methods. And I don't mean this in any derogatory or negative way towards the Russians at all. I'm telling you that they had to survive under these circumstances. That's a different story. They grew up distrusting government and distrusting authority figures. And we come to them, we're the authority figures, we're the Torah Jews, and we're ready to help you. And they snicker. And they're taught all their lives, not all their lives, generations and generations, take what you can and get out of there. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. That's the way they were brought up. And we didn't know that. And we wake up too late. They took what they wanted and we didn't get what we wanted. It was an abysmal failure. Teenagers, too, are a totally different culture. They have their own way of speaking, even though they have the same desires as us. They have their own honor system. Be an example. Teenagers don't understand the ideal of responsibility. They understand responsibility in terms of don't do something bad to somebody else. They don't understand responsibility as an ideal in itself. We know that if there's somebody unemployed sitting on the street with nothing to do with himself, that person is a scourge on society, and we have to help him and change that somehow. The teenagers don't look at it like that. Teenagers do look at responsibility as an important thing, but only because responsibility will hurt somebody else. And therefore, if you tell a teenager that you don't appreciate what your parents are doing, or if you're a parent, you don't appreciate what I'm doing and you're not grateful for what I'm doing, that won't wash, because they're going to look at you and they're going to think, what do you mean grateful? What do you mean appreciate? What did I do wrong to you? What is your problem? What trick are you using now? What rules now are you using to get me to do what you want? What did I do to you? If you want to get a teenager to listen, when you want to tell them to be appreciative, just change the wording. Tell the teenager, you're a user. We'll cut right to the quick. User is one of the two or three worst things that a teenager can be. Because a user means not that you're irresponsible, not that you have a bad midah, but that you hurt somebody else. It means the same thing. You tell a teenager you're an ingrate, you're not appreciative, it means nothing to him. You tell him you're a user, I guarantee you, not 99% of the time, 100% of the time, you'll get a response. Maybe not what you want, but it'll go into their head and they'll understand exactly what you're talking about. Let this suffice as an introduction. In our organization, we perceive teenagers as very much the same as their adult counterparts. Just as coming from a different country, it's coming from a different world. And we treat them accordingly. We have particular techniques that we use to deal with our acting out teenagers. As I said before, some of them you may agree with, some of them you may even know about, and some of them you may look at and shake your heads no. In our experience, this is what works. First, we have to understand this. No matter what techniques you use on a teenager, the techniques have to be able to be communicated to him. You can have the greatest presentation in the world. Besides the presentation, you need a method to be able to put through the walls that teenagers put up between them and adults. For this, we have to understand how people communicate with each other. We all know about body language, right? Body language. If you ask somebody, are you happy with my performance? And he says like this, yes, I am. Very happy. You know what that means. People talk with words, but the message that's given over has very little to do with words. It has to do with body language and things like that. But I'm not here to talk about body language. You know all about that. I'm here to talk about what's called subtitles. Like in the movies, where you have a title, and then underwards you have a subtitle. There are words, and there are the deeper meaning of the words. Girl goes over to father. Senior, 17 years old. This really happened. And she tells the father, Father, Tata Mina, I have a confession to make. I've been living a double life for the last 4 years. Since 8th grade. Double life has a lot to do with boys. She said it a lot differently, but this was the gist. This child didn't tell the father one thing. This child told the father two things. Or maybe three and four. Told the father A, that there's a problem with her double life that she's been leading that had to do with boys. But then in the subtitle it also says, B, I'm scared of you and for the past 4 years I never told you this. C, if I was leading a double life, that means all my friends know about it. And you're the last person in my life who I trust with this secret. Now if this girl is trying to communicate with the father, is not A. She's trying to communicate, in all probability, B and C. Because words can lie. Words can be manipulated. Words can hide things. But the subtitles under the words always tell the truth. When this kid goes to the father has to be able to read that. And to be able to respond first to the problem of the girl's fear of him for the past 4 years. Because that's the girl's primary problem, and that's what she's trying to communicate to him. Usually the father will fly off the handle. And the message that that gives to the kid is, I'm trying to tell something to you. I'm trying to communicate this to you. And you didn't listen. You don't understand me. It happens all the time. Kid will tell something to the father or to the mother. The mother and the father will register what the kid said. They'll have a confrontation. And maybe even it won't be a violent confrontation. Maybe even it'll be nice and calm and peaceful. But the kid will come out afterwards saying, the father, my mother, they don't understand me. reason is because the kid was trying to communicate something that she herself didn't even realize. They're not poets. They're not the greatest communicators in the world. Adults aren't either. And everybody knows that couples don't argue over a smashed car. If they argue over a smashed car, they're really arguing over the fact that he leaves the toilet seat off or that she leaves the toothpaste uncovered. Little things that come out later. It's the same thing with kids. There are little things that are trying to be communicated, and it's not in the words themselves. People communicate with these subtitles. Kids try to tell us things, and we have to tune into them. But you know what? We use this to our advantage. You have to try to figure out what kind of subtitles your message is giving to the kids. And you can use that to your advantage. Case in point, child comes to a psychologist or to a therapist, to a social worker, whatever. And social worker is trying to be makar of the kid and trying to explain to the kids that she's his friend. Okay. Kid tells everything to social workers, pours out his heart. Social worker is sitting there analyzing the kid. This is what's happening, and this all that she's doing is talking about him. What message is he getting? And don't forget, she may be writing notes. And a little piece of paper that's sitting on top of a manila file folder. What message is the kid getting? There's a file in the cabinet. I'm your friend. I'm here to help you. For 45 minutes and $90 for the 45-minute session, afterwards you go into the file. Now, the psychologist, the therapist doesn't say that. That's the message that the kid gets. The kid thinks that this psychologist thinking about him even for 1 second after 5 o'clock in the afternoon, after hours are over. I'm your friend, I'm trying to help you, I care about you. That's what you're trying to give over to him. After you're gone, I don't think about you until next week when you come back. And then I have to open up my notes. Last week, this is what we spoke about. That doesn't work. You're telling him you care about him, but the subtitles under you are telling him something very, very different. The biggest influence in the life of a child, of a teenager, are his friends. Bigger influence than the parents, bigger influence than the teachers. The influence is the friends. Therefore, rule number one, and please refer to that Project Rejuvenation document 16. This is the... You have it? Okay. Project Rejuvenation document 16, rules for dealing with acting out teenagers. This document, this piece of paper, is given out to anybody that comes to either volunteer or to work with us. Part of our training is that they have to understand these four rules. But of course, all these four rules only work in conjunction with rule that's rule number A, before anything. The Aleph base is, listen to the subtitles under what the kid is saying and speak back in such a way that the subtitles are going to get through. Okay, we're going to come back to that later. And I'm going to show you how it pertains to each rule. Rule number one, the greatest influence on a teenager is his friends. Therefore, if you want to have an influence on a teenager, be his friend. Isn't that logical? Greatest influence on a teenager is his friends. Therefore, if you want to have an influence, be a friend. Even better, be his best friend. Now we have over here, there's the do's and the don'ts and the do's, but we put it under Sumei Ra and Asei Tov, that's our terminology. The first rule is, do not make him a file in your drawer, because a friend is not a case. Somebody in a social service agency, a Jewish religious social service agency, once wanted to give to a kid, a delinquent kid in Manhattan, my telephone number for him to call me. But first, what he did was, he pulled out a little piece of paper and made the kid asked the kid to sign that the kid gives this guy Rishus permission to give me his phone number. The kid looked at him like he's crazy. He didn't want to sign because he was scared of the paper. And I came later to the agency to talk about it, and I told them, when I give you my friend's phone number, I don't take out a piece of paper and ask you to sign. And the guy tells me, but it's for his own protection. And as professionals, you know what he means. But my answer is, a straitjacket is also for his protection. And what do you think a kid would, how he would react if you come after him with a straitjacket? this kid sees automatically that he's a case. He's not a friend, he's a case. Your friends don't sign papers before you give out phone numbers. Cases do. And a kid does not want to be a case. If he's a case, you lost him 50%. Because you lost the friend status. Don't ever let him see you taking those notes, unless that's the role you want to play. If you want to play official therapist, fine. I'm not talking about that. We don't do that. Even our therapists play the role of friends. They're not there. For therapy, we send them somewhere else. But we are friends of the kids. The other name besides Project Rejuvenation that was considered for our corporation is Friends Incorporated. That's what we are. And through that, we exert a tremendous amount of influence on them. And the first thing is, even though we do have files on the kids, you know nothing about it, they can't know anything about it, it's only for our records, and our relationship with them, their perception of us, is just friends. Second rule, don't be frightened of him. That kid in the pamphlet, the first one, the before and after, his first name is Yoni. This Yoni, who by the way posed for those pictures, and at the point where that pamphlet was printed, he was a member of a roving motorcycle gang in Manhattan. The half-naked, pockmarked people that drive around with their motorcycles. That's what he was. He used to shoot ducks for food up in the mountains because they just went around and they didn't have stores in that area to buy things. They would party out in the woods all the time. 13 years old, that was his bar mitzvah. 16 years old, he's even wearing the same glasses in the picture. That kid, now, today, looks like this. Pass it around, I don't have copies of this picture. He's back, he's Hasidish again. Everything's fine. The first time I met this kid, I want to tell you the circumstances. And this I heard from him, not from me. This kid spoke by reception we had in front of 200 people, telling his story of rejection and return. And he mentioned two things that we did that had the greatest impact on him. Now this kid, when I first heard about him, they were telling me, this kid, Yoni, he's crazy. Stay away from him. Guns, drugs, motorcycles, gangs, tattoos, earrings, nose rings, whatever you want, he was into that. Two things he said in public. That picture of him, the after-after picture, was taken at our reception. He went and said two things that we did had the biggest impact on him. The first thing is the first day I met him. We had a rap session type meetings, we call it, four kids in Flatbush in our old office on East 27th Street Avenue. This kid came on his motorcycle. And we're sitting there talking, and all of a sudden you hear from outside, vroom, vroom, vroom. He had nothing to do except make us aware of his presence out on the corner. So I put it into neutral, and he was vroom, vroom, vrooming for about 5-10 minutes until he knew he got our attention. He comes in with his leather jacket, and on top of the leather jacket was a denim vest, and on top of the denim vest was this necklace. He's wearing it over there in the picture. It says biker with a skull and a knife through the skull. He was wearing his leather boots that each one was decorated in the back with 6 live bullets in the back of his boots, with his jean and his chains and his gold and his silver and his motorcycle helmet. He comes into the room, lays down on the floor. There's a room about 3/4 the size of this one. He lays down on the floor, leaning on his elbow, takes off his helmet with his other hand and says, Shalom Aleichem. It's a quote. Now, he was testing me. What am I supposed to do? He just came in and made his royal entrance. If I ignore him, what does that mean to him? What do the subtitles under the silence say? I don't know what to tell you. I don't know how to handle you. I want to tell you something, but I don't have the words. You win, I lose. If I tell him, Yoni, please have a seat in a chair, he would probably refuse. So what is that? What do the subtitles under that tell him? In that case, Yoni, you have to be formal over here. And I can't deal with you the way you are on the street. I will not. What I did was, I leaned over to him and I said, you've got to lend me that outfit this Purim. And he smiled, and he sat up and got into a chair. He did lend me the outfit on motorcycle down Ocean Parkway on Purim. That was the beginning of a very, very wonderful relationship. The idea is not to be frightened, not even frightened out of saying something. It's like a little baby. You know, if you have a baby at home, and let's say the baby is struggling to walk, and the baby trips and falls. Now, the fall wasn't hard enough to really hurt the baby and to make it cry. But if you go over to the baby, oh my God, what happened to you? The baby will immediately burst out crying because the baby gets scared. Because you got scared. You just scared the baby into crying. It's the same thing with these kids. If you go over to the baby and you're not scared, you pick him up, okay, get up. He'll cooperate. These kids are trying to scare people. Not necessarily trying to scare them onto the other side of the street, even though they do that. They're trying to scare their parents. They're trying to scare their rebbeim. Maybe they're trying to scare somebody that they're going to go off the derech. Maybe they're going to try to scare somebody that they're going to do something stupid to themselves. Maybe they're trying to scare somebody that they're going to damage another kid, influence him in a negative way, or whatever. They carry guns, and they wear leather, and they drive these motorcycles, and they're trying to scare people. You know why? I'm not a psychiatrist, but I'm a friend of these kids. And they're trying to scare everybody because they themselves are scared of themselves. There's a pasuk in Mishle, Lifnei Ga'oin, Lifnei Shever Ga'oin, which means, thank you, before the fall, the person is very, very high. Notice the higher they are, the harder they fall. And simple meaning of the pasuk is that if God puts somebody up over there, he's setting him up for a fall, so don't worry. But there's another translation. Lifnei doesn't have to mean before chronologically. It means before, like Da Lifnei Niata Omeid, in the face of Lifnei. Lifnei Shever, in the face of brokenness. How does a person react? Gone. They blow themselves up. This kid's scared of himself. And he's testing us to see if his fear is real, is justified or not. And if you're scared of him, then your subtitle just told him, you are a scary character. And your fear of yourself is justified. And how can a person live with himself if he's scared of himself? Maybe he doesn't understand what he's feeling inside. Maybe he knows that he's a little rebellious, and he knows that he's headed on a one-way trip to Palookaville. He knows that he has no future in front of him. Maybe he knows that he's really ruining his life, deep down, and he's scared of that. Maybe the things that he feels, he doesn't know how to handle as a teenager, and he's scared of that. And he wants to know, should I be scared or should I not be scared? So when he comes over to you with his guns and his leather and all of these things, and he says Shalom Aleichem, the subtitle to that Shalom Aleichem is, this is how I feel. Should I be scared? Just like when that kid falls, there's a little 1 second that they look up a little confused. What's going on here? And your answer better not be, yes, you are scary, and you should be scared, because somebody scared of themselves is in very bad shape. The truth of the matter is that they're really a lot less scary than they come across. And this is an analogy, not a comparison. I don't mean it in any derogatory way. Like dogs, if you are scared of them, they'll smell that fear. And then they'll be dangerous. I've spoken to very, very dangerous motorcycle gangs, and to criminals, and to people involved in all sorts of violent crimes and drug habits. And the kunz is very simple. If you're not scared of them, they're not going to be scary. And I don't mean to come up and say like Rabbi Chanan Wasserman did to the Nazis when they came in with a gun to a shir. He opened up his jacket and said, shoot, I'm not scared. That's not the type of courage that I'm referring to. I'm just referring to calm, cool, and casual. You're a person, I'm a person. I wear wool, you wear leather. You're involved in crimes? What does it have to do with me? You're a drug addict? What does it have to do with me? You're a person, I'm a person. If I'm not going to treat you with respect, at least I'm going to treat you like a person. That's all. In other words, like his friend. Because he has friends, this guy, in this head of the motorcycle gang. He has friends. Maybe they're heads of other motorcycle gangs, and maybe they're members of his own. And how do they look at him? They perform violence on each other, these people. They're dangerous to each other just as much as they're dangerous to us. And yet, they interact with each other in a relatively social way, successfully, because they're just not scared. They understand. You can't be scared. And it doesn't have to be a guy with a gun in his pocket to be scared of him. The kid walks into your office just a little off and he says he's going to kill himself, this, that. You're supposed to care and you're supposed to protect him. But the fear that he's trying to instill in you, that he's trying to validate and justify within himself, can't be validated and justified. Don't be scared. That's rule number two, because friends aren't scared. You may be scared out of concern, but that's not fear. It's not the same emotion. Whatever chemicals are secreted when a person's scared of danger are not the same as when a person is scared because you care about somebody. They're homonyms, the word scared, in those two contexts, but they don't at all mean the same thing. Rule number three, don't play the role of helper. Help because you're a friend. Don't be a friend because you help. I met this girl last week. Parents called me, they came to me, Chol HaMoed Pesach it was. They found the girl's boyfriend, they found some notes she wrote, whatever. They're all scared. The way I get in to a kid like that is, these kids, they all have friends or friends of friends, and soon, somewhere down the line, there's somebody there that I already know. Yeah. They form their own subculture. And I ask for an introduction. The same way, let's say, that if you want to collect money for an organization from a big businessman, what do? You go to a friend of his that you know and say, could you please introduce me? That's the way to do it. And I'm in immediately. The girl's reaction was, everybody wants to help me, but I have no friends. That's what she said. She called me up nevertheless under duress from this other kid, and I said, listen, I said, Rachel, I promise you I'm not going to help you. I said, I don't care how much trouble you're in, I'm not going to help you. I'll only be your friend. And that's such an easy thing to fake, but I wasn't faking. And the girl was so desperate for friends, she immediately grabbed it. And then when she asked for help, I said, that was the deal. And she says, that's not fair. She's right. I was only playing with her. But you help because you're a friend. You don't become a friend because you help. There are roles to play for helpers with kids. And that's the job of the therapists and in their context. But I can just tell you my experience and what I do. We don't play the role of helper. We play the role of friend. And you all know from your lives, and I don't really know any of you, but I'm certain that every single one of you here in this room knows from your lives that when you needed help, the first person that came running was a good friend. And you know how valuable that is. And the first person you'll go to if you need help is a real good friend if you're lucky enough to have one. And therefore, I don't have to run after the kids, trying to help them, or trying to figure out a way to get them into my office for their help. They come to me. Not the first week, not the second week, not the third week. But I become a friend. I'm an adult friend who's employed, who knows people, who has his 2 feet on the ground, hopefully. Okay? And if they're in trouble, and if they have a friend like that, they're going to make a beeline in that direction. I just have to wait. And they always, invariably come. But you know what? These kids have guidance counselors, and these kids have teachers, and these kids have parents, and they don't go to them. Because people will always run to the friend before they'll run to the helper. With exceptions, but generally that's the rule. People will run to the friends before they'll run to their professional helper. And we all know that the teachers, the parents, the guidance counselors are really the last people to know what's going on with these kids' lives. The friends always know first. So therefore, instead of trying to break down the wall between you and the kids, instead of trying to climb over it or go around it or dig under it, there's a much simpler way. Be on the other side with them. Let them invite you in. You don't have to break down any wall. Let the wall stay there between the kid and all the other adults in the world. You're on the other side of the wall with the kid. You are a friend. And then you're in. And then you're in. Now, there are disadvantages to this approach. Now, the mother calls me and says, well, you have to explain to my daughter that she said Saturday night she'll be here 9:30 at night and she came back at 1 o'clock in the morning. I can't do that immediately. Her teacher can, her guidance counselor can. I can't do that right away. That's not the way I work. Maybe somebody else in a helping position can explain that to her. But friends don't do that. I can explain to her, I say, look, your mother's going ballistic. There's going to be lots of conflict over there. Maybe we could figure out a way. To get her to let you stay out a little later, maybe a compromise, something like that. But it's like a friend. It's not a helper. That's the disadvantage. You can't always do what's needed to do right away. But no approach is perfect. And these are the disadvantages of this one. Those are the three rules, the three sur meiras, the three don'ts about being a friend. Don't make them a case. Don't be frightened of them, because friends aren't frightened of friends. And don't play the role of helper. Meaning, help them because you're a friend. Don't be a friend because you're a helper. Then there's the things, the ase tov, the do's. Now I know that different therapists feel differently about this. But from where I'm standing, it's a good thing to do. The first rule is let him see the real you. I think they call it self-disclosure in the professional circles. It's very worthwhile for kids to know that their parents, their teachers, their rabbis, their therapists are not perfect. And they never were. You know, there's a shaila in the Rambam about a student that the Rebbe did something wrong to the student. The Rebbe was wrong. And the student wanted the Rebbe to ask Mechila, but the Rebbe didn't want to. Because he felt it's undermining the role of the Rebbe to go to the student to say, I was wrong, you Meichel me, because then you're empowering the student. Meichel you, well, it depends. What did I get in last report card? You know what the Rambam says? The Rambam says that the Rebbe has to ask Mechila from the student, that's the halacha. Because the Rebbe is a human being like everybody else. And all human beings are bound to the laws of Hashem. Including the Rebbe. Why must we have to be role models. But a role model is only effective if a child feels that they can attain the level of the role model. So often I hear it from kids. I can't be good. I can't be successful. I can't grow up to be a religious person. Look at me. Look at what I do. I can't. The answer is you can. Because nobody in the world is perfect. Friendship is a two-way street. You can't expect your friend to pour out their heart to you and to tell you all about their problems, and you're sitting there just absorbing it, not giving anything back. Now, I know that it's not realistic or viable or even advisable for therapists to start to lay down on the couch and to tell the problems to the patient. But there has to be some element of humanity in the therapist or in the friends, because that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about friends, even an adult friend, for the kids to be able to use that person as a role model. It's ironic. But a friend can be a much greater role model than some larger-than-life figure on top of a pedestal. Because a larger-than-life figure on top of a pedestal, you don't really believe that you can ever get there. So what is it a role model for? It may be a direction, like a North Star, for a direction for you to go in that way, even though you'll never get there. That it could serve as. But it's so much more effective, so much more potent, if the kid feels, I want to grow up to be like you. And he can only feel that way if he feels, I can grow up to be like you. When you were a kid, you went through the same things as he did. I have no problem revealing that. I have no problem telling that to the kids who I deal with. With a snicker on my face after they tell me the problem, as if they're the first person in the world to encounter this thing, I say, I want to tell you a story when I was 16 years old. And there's nothing wrong with that. It works marvelously. Again, I don't know if you're a professional in a profession sitting in the leather chair over there with the patient on the other side of the desk. I don't know if it's advisable or even feasible in your positions. But if somehow you can incorporate an element of humanism, some real friendly relationship between you and the person who you're trying to influence, it helps a lot. Friends share interests. If you know something that this kid is interested in, and you're interested in the same thing, tell him. And you know, forget about for a second that he's under your guidance and your care. Let's say you like to collect sports cars or something. And this kid is into sports cars. He mentions it, put your notes to the side, and you say, really? And for a few minutes, it's an investment in time, because it'll gain you a lot more in the long run. Share interests with him. We're so reluctant to do that. We are so reluctant to step down from our pedestal and to show them that we are human. But it's not right. There's nothing wrong with being human. And these kids, for their own sanity and their own sake, have to know that they can be successful and they can straighten out their lives without becoming superhuman, because they think that in order to straighten out their lives, they need to become something that they are not cut out to be. And that's wrong. And how do you show them it's wrong? Yeah, you can tell them, well, nobody's perfect and everything, and in the meantime, they don't believe it. Yeah, nobody's perfect. Yes, Moshe Rabbeinu hit the stone. He wasn't perfect either. But what does it have to do with what I'm feeling? What does that have to do with what I want? The kid is thinking. What the kid has to see, not just be told, is that upstanding citizens in the community, people who are successful, people whose lives are straight and not messed up, are human beings. That's what it says here. Friendship is a two-way street, and you want him to open up to you. If he opens up to you without you opening up to him, now of course you can use discretion, but without any reciprocal part of the relationship, then you're not a friend. You're a professional. He's a case. You're not a friend. Friendship is a two-way street. Doesn't mean you have to tell him all your secrets. But there has to be some sort of reciprocal self-disclosure in order for him, if you're going to use the friend approach. And then the next one, be on his team. Okay. I was once sitting in front of a classroom, seniors, girls, 17-year-olds, and the girl, they were eating, it was like between periods, and one girl didn't make a bracha. Religious school, from school. Girl tells other girl, why don't you make a bracha? And girl says, I don't give my parents the satisfaction. Happens all the time. And I feel it's misdiagnosed. It's misdiagnosed as an act of spite, a lahachis, to spite the parents. I really feel that that's a misdiagnosis, that's not it. What's happening is the phenomenon that was given to us by a great tzaddik about 200 years ago, Rabbi Yonis and Ibishitz. He had a very interesting psychological observation. He said that if a balabas will call his rabbi about a cow that he just slaughtered, and he has a question about whether the cow is kosher. And he asks the rabbi, Shailen, the rabbi says, well, it's not kosher, you have to throw it out. Now, this cow is worth $1,000, let's say. Nevertheless, he'll throw out the cow. He will be willing to forego those $1,000 for the sake of doing what's right. That same balabas, perhaps, will appear in front of the same rabbi, perhaps, in a din Torah, in a court case with somebody else. The rabbi will paskin in favor of the other person. $1,000 was at stake. He lost. All of a sudden he gets angry at the rabbi. He says he's a crook and this whole thing was fixed and it's not true. Happens all the time. So what's the difference? If you're willing to throw out your $1,000 cow because that's the right thing to do, what bothers you so much that he said you have to give this guy $1,000 because that's the right thing to do? So Rabbi Yonis and Ibishitz said, that's not the $1,000 that's bothering this guy. It's the fact that he lost. At a cow, you throw out the cow, you're a hero. You're a religious guy. You're a winner. Look what I did. In the Din Torah, the other guy won and you lost. It doesn't matter how much money. The subtitle under the money is the defeat. Nobody wants to be a loser. Everybody wants to be a success and a winner. Nobody wants to be a loser. No matter how much money you have, no matter how much power you have, no matter how famous you are, if you think you're a loser, it's worth nothing. Therefore, if a parent tells a kid, you will make a bracha, let's say kid's reluctant, you will do as I say, you will make this bracha, you'll see. What happened there is that the parents just set up a game where if the kid does make a bracha, who wins and who loses? The kid says, I will not. And the parent says, yes, you will. Over my dead body, you won't. Kid changes, makes the bracha. Parent wins, kid loses. You will not see that friend ever again. Yes, I will. No, you won't. Yes, I will. That kid doesn't want to be a loser. Forget about the friend. Forget about the bracha. There's a religious girl. What money does it cost her to make the bracha? If she makes the bracha, her parents won and she lost. And she doesn't want to be a loser. Parents can make a terrible mistake of setting themselves up on a different team, on an opposing side of the rope in a tug of war with their kids, such that they are giving the kids the greatest motivation in the world never to improve. Because if you improve, you're a loser. I'm a winner. I won. There are kids who ruin their lives in order to win the game with the parents. Yes, I'm going to force you to do this and you will do it and you will listen to me and I'm smarter than you and I know by sending you to this school you're going to improve and I'm the parent and I'm older than you and I'm smarter than you and you'll see I'm going to straighten you out. And the kid says, you'll see, you won't. And the kid will ruin his whole life just not to lose that battle with his parents. And by the time he realizes that he's playing a game, he's all in a game, it's too late. This girl is not spiting her parents. It's not spite. Girl doesn't want to be a loser. If you want to criticize somebody, if you want to tell them what to do, if you want to give them advice or suggestion, you have to make sure that it's a win-win situation. And in this context, win-win means, Rachelah, I'm the father. You make this bracha, we both win. You win and I win. You're not on the other side. We're on the same side. A kid has to be able to feel that the parent and the kid are on the same side. Father and mother came to me last week about a kid who's in yeshiva here, Baruch Park Hasidish Yeshiva. And, well, this kid was a problem. His father wasn't Jewish. His mother was a Geiris. He's a Jewish kid. The parents broke up and the mother remarried and now they became Balei Tshuva and they're all from. The kid's a brilliant boy, but he has this complex because he knows his father wasn't Jewish, he comes from a mother's a Geiris, and he has an inferiority complex despite the fact that he's straight A student without studying. And so he's obsessed, this kid, with getting his Rebbe to like him and getting everybody to think that he's smart and becoming liked by everybody. And the father he looks down at, because the father has barely a basic remedial Jewish education, and this kid is honors in regular Hasidic high school. And the father has no relationship with the kid. So you know what I told him? I said, look, the kid has this thing. He has this mishigas. His goal, his objective, is to make people think that he's smart. No. It's not healthy, perhaps, but it should be the worst thing that any kid ever wanted. Therefore, in this case, go over to him and tell him, you know, Yainasan, I'm going to help you. We're together going to think of ways for you to get in the right side of your rebellion and for you to be liked by your friends. He thinks he's not liked and he thinks not. Fine. Be with him. Give him advice. Help him with his reports. If he's crazy and he wants to stay up till 2 o'clock in the morning to perfect the cover, do it with him. Why? Because this father is not in a position, he's not qualified nor able to change this kid's problem. The kid will either grow out of it or realize it himself, or he'll need professional help, but the father will not. The father's job is to be able to have an open, communicating relationship with the kid. And in order to do that, in order for the kid to accept the father telling him, this is your curfew, the kid has to feel that he and the father have the same goals, they're playing the same game. A football coach can speak to the football players, you know how? You stupid morons! You idiots! You don't know what you're doing! You're a bunch of buffoons! And they'll sit there listening to all that abusive rhetoric. And maybe, best case scenario, during the next game, they'll run out and try even harder. But never are they going to be insulted. They're not going to be resentful. It happens all the time. You know why? Because the kids know, the players know, that the coach wants to win this game just as much as they do. They're not on different sides, they're on the same side. Parents always ask me, how strict should I be? How liberal should I be? Strict and liberal really isn't the issue. From the over 200 kids that I've dealt with in the past 2 years, there is no common denominator regarding how strict the parents were or how permissive the parents were, barring extremes, of course. But there is a common denominator regarding if the kids feel that the parents relate to them or not. If the kids feel that the parents, they're fighting a war against the parents, they're going to fight to the bitter end. As a friend, you cannot make that mistake that those parents make. Those kids have to feel that you're on their side. I know a psychologist who, in family therapy, he will usually deal only with the kid, and he has a friend who he gives the parents over to. and he will work in conjunction with that friend of his. But he won't work with the parents and the kid together. And the reason is because then it's a question of taking sides in the perception of the kid. You're on their side, you're on their side. In his approach, I am yours. Parents is a different issue. As a friend, if you're taking the friend approach, the kid has to feel that you are his or hers. Doesn't mean you have to approve of everything he does. Remember, friends don't approve of everything their friends do. You don't have to approve of everything. You don't have to agree to everything. Friends disagree. Friends even insult friends. Friends are abusive. But they remain friends because they know that there's this friendship between them. There's this common bond. They're on the same side. And that's what the kid has to feel. And if he does, then you're in. Next, have him on your mind. Friends think about each other even after business hours. Kid comes to you once a week. First week he comes to you and he mentions to you that he hangs out in this and this place. Next week, you know, I was driving by the street over there, and I stopped to take a look at what this place is that you told me about last week. That has such an effect on a kid. A kid knows that you're thinking about him, and you can't care about him unless you think about him, unless you care about him as a file in your cabinet. The kid has to think that you're thinking about him. If the kid makes a statement, pick it up. The kid mentions his favorite color. The kid mentions his birthday. The kid mentions a friend of his that was killed or something like that. In passing. And as far as he's concerned, it went in one ear and out the other of yours.